Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Welcome to an hour with me, and as always, an extremely interesting guest. Before telling her about you, about her, let me remind you that in April, our conference is coming up. The third Peter Bregan Empathic Therapy Conference. It's an international conference. Last year, we had about 200 folks, which is very close to our capacity of about 210. We are registering people at least as fast a rate as last year. It's possible, and I'm not fooling, it is possible, despite the economy, that we may fill up. So sign up for the Empathic Therapy Conference at empathictherapy.org or almost anything like that. My wife is very clever and careful about these things, so even if you don't get the spelling of empathictherapy.org exact, it'll probably bounce in there, but do your best. The conference is April 26, a Friday, 27, a Saturday, and half of 28, a Sunday. You'll get lots of time to meet me and hear me, but we, as usual, have a couple of dozen marvelous speakers from around the world. My next week, I think I'll start out and give you a list of these amazing people. And just all the folks that come to our conference are really outstanding. And they are warm, caring people. That's whom we attract. Many folks feel like their lives are changed by our conferences, made better, of course. The conference has two themes, as always, although the speakers and presenters most change, although we keep a few on from the previous year. The themes are the criticism of biological psychiatry, diagnosing drugs, objectifying people, making kids into objects to be tinkered with drugs, and making old people into slaves at nursing homes who are supposed to sit down and shut up. You know, it's funny. Psychiatry gets us at both ends to sit down and shut up, first in school and then in our nursing homes. They just drug us to conform to the institutions at the beginning and at the end. And if we get frail or show any signs of weakness like a limping deer in a herd, the psychiatry will be on you in between childhood and old age. A bit metaphorical for me today, but it's a good way to start. The other part that we talk about at least as much and sometimes more are the better approaches to healing, self-healing, healing through professional therapy, better approaches to counseling, but always also with ordinary folks in mind who are not professionals. Doesn't make you ordinary, of course. So people who are professional, people who have been injured by psychiatry, people who want to learn more about how to help themselves and others, all are welcome at the third annual Empathic Therapy Conference. It's in Syracuse, New York, April 26, 27, 28, and go to empathictherapy.org to learn more about it. My guest today, and I hope she's hooked in, Dr. Quirk, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Good. You sound good and clear. She is, and she may need to help me with the pronunciation. I hope I get it right. Nino Alexandri Quirk. She's an
pretty
MD.
Close.
Is that pretty close?
Pretty close. It's actually Nino.
Nino.
But it's a tough name for people to pronounce.
It is, even though we've talked on the phone extensively. Let me spell it for folks. It's the first name is hyphenated. Ninu is N-I-N-U hyphen, and then Alexandri, A-L-E-X-A-N-D-R-I, and then Quirk, Q-U-I-R-K. Ninu, I'm Peter. Hello again. She's a medical doctor whose practice was transformed when she became ill and needed medical care. This led her to getting a board certification in holistic medicine, and she now focuses on restoring one patient, one life at a time, which is a very good principle, one that Ginger and I, by the way, often come back to. When we're feeling overwhelmed, when we're feeling we just can't make enough change, we remember the old story of a little boy walking along the beach and whole bunches of starfishes have washed up, and every few steps he throws one of 100 back into the ocean. And his parents ask him, you know, you're not getting a lot done that way. You know, I mean, look at all the starfish on the beach. And he says, well, but I just saved that one, and here I go again after another. It's a good idea. Her work is based on science, but the real magic, she tells us, is the new kind of doctor-patient relationship that gives power back to patients, helping them to improve their physical and mental health, transforming their lives. We're so similar on that. It's the exact principle of my new book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And she tries to integrate, and this is where it's going to get especially interesting in many ways. She tries to integrate biochemistry, genetic typing, and nutritional profiling. And as we talked on the phone about it, some of that, despite the wonderful overall agreement we have, makes my head spin a little. So we'll have a little fun talking about that, too. Dr. Quirk, hello.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm a little more full of levity at the start today, probably from working so hard right up to the show today, Ninu, that I hardly had a chance to take a breather. So my breather is the introduction to the show. Where would you like to begin?
Well, maybe with a little background of what happened to me and how that changed my life as a person and as a doctor. I've always been a really high-energy person. In addition to working full-time in a medical practice, I had an 11-acre farm. I was on the go probably 16 even 20 hours a day, never felt tired, never felt slowed down. I was really excited about being alive and all the stuff I was doing. And then I had my little midway on the path of life experience, like Dante's Inferno, where I had arthritis in my feet, which I had been ignoring for a long time, just through it. So finally I had to have surgery to fix it. So I had surgery on both feet at once, which meant I was under anesthesia for a few hours. And then when I woke up, I followed my doctor's instructions very carefully. Every 4 to 6 hours, I took a pain pill around the clock for the first 2 weeks, and then after that, only used them as needed. And I found during those first 2 weeks that I was extremely fuzzy. It seemed like I had never really woken up fully from the anesthesia. I was tired, sleepy, groggy, disconnected, and at first, I thought it was just I hadn't woken up and I was going to metabolize it off and everything would be fine. Unfortunately, that wasn't true. The fatigue got worse and worse. I started developing really bad short-term memory loss, unable to find objects, leaving my keys in the ignition of my car, not remembering what I had just read, word-finding difficulties, all these things. And I had always had a fantastic memory. You need that for medical school. So I was very frightened by this lack of memory, because there's a lot of Alzheimer's disease in my family, and I was quite frightened that perhaps I was starting to develop Alzheimer's. So
that
I went
really
to my
must, that must have been terrifying, Ninu.
It was.
That's going to resonate with a lot of folks. Well, go ahead.
So I went to my internist, and he said, your labs are all fine. He checked my thyroid, my complete blood count, the usual standard labs. You're fine. It's just menopause. Go see your gynecologist. So I went to see the gynecologist, and she checked my hormones, and she said, well, yeah, you're probably right on the edge of menopause. Probably that's where your symptoms are coming from. But at this point, I had already practiced medicine for almost 15 years. I had seen hundreds and hundreds of women going through menopause, and none of them had the symptoms I had. So I was very concerned about my memory. I went to a couple of neurology conferences, and in those conferences, the topic of the day was that mitochondrial dysfunction was the defining factor in developing Alzheimer's disease. So sending off on my own, I sent off all of these lab tests to check my mitochondrial function, and it turned out that my mitochondria had actually shut down, pretty much had stopped producing ATP, that's the energy molecule that you need to feel peppy. And when that happens in a person, you've only got one other pathway left, and that's called the lactic acidosis pathway. And so my body was surviving for every bit of sugar I ate. Instead of making 38 molecules of ATP, I could only make 2 molecules of ATP using that other pathway. That's why I was so profoundly fatigued. Mitochondria are the little energy powerhouses of the cell. Certain organs have lots of mitochondria, like your brain cells will have thousands, tens of thousands of mitochondria in every cell. Your liver also has tens of thousands, and all your muscle cells. Those are the three organs, muscles, brain, and liver, have the most mitochondria. So when you end up with a mitochondrial problem, one of those target organs is going to be where your symptoms are located. In my case, it was the brain, probably because my family with the Alzheimer's history has a genetic weakness of brain mitochondria. So once I found out what my problem was, then I had to figure out how to treat it. And it turns out almost no doctors know, because in the old days, they figured there's only one kind of mitochondrial disease. You're born with it, and you're sick as a child. You get diagnosed then. The idea that adults could just acquire a mitochondrial illness is a whole new thing, just coming out maybe in the past 10 years in the medical literature. And it turns out that certain prescription drugs and certain toxins like pesticides can cause mitochondrial dysfunction. And so what I had was drug-induced mitochondrial dysfunction coming from the anesthesia that I had taken and the Tylenol that was in my pain reliever. Tylenol is a very potent mitochondrial poison. And so because I had taken it every day around the clock for 2 weeks, I had basically shut off my mitochondria's ability to make ATP. It took me almost 2 years to get better. And because there's actually no prescription drugs available for mitochondrial diseases, even if you're diagnosed with them in childhood, there's only holistic types of treatments, exercise, rest, massage, getting lots of fluid, taking certain vitamins and supplements, eating a particular way. And that opened the door for me going on to getting a new board certification in holistic health. And recognizing, too, that because mitochondria are in every cell of your body, that, hey, wait a minute, maybe people have mitochondrial dysfunction. And that's when I started treating other people who maybe didn't have the frank, extreme mitochondrial dysfunction that I had acquired. But, for instance, since mitochondria metabolize all the carbs, the fat, and the protein you eat and turn them into ATP to give you energy, what about people with other kinds of issues there? What about people with high cholesterol, diabetes, any kind of sugar, fat, or protein metabolism problem ultimately is a mitochondrial issue. And that opens the door for an awful lot of patients to benefit from these kinds of treatments.
Now, how many colleagues are working with you on this issue? Honestly, it's all new to me. I have no idea about its validity. Certainly, what you're saying sounds perfectly rational and plausible. Do you have a group of colleagues who are working together? Do you have an organization?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are actually a couple of big organizations in America. They started really as programs for either children or parents of children with mitochondrial disease, but they have in the past several years expanded to include adults. And I will get you those names in a moment. Those aren't on the tip of my tongue. But I have to say that other than the doctors who started out taking care of medical metabolic diseases of children, there's not a lot of people who do adult metabolism in America. There's a guy up at Tufts in Boston. There's a fellow down at Duke in North Carolina. There's myself. It's a fairly small pool of actual clinicians who do this kind of work for adults. But when you look on the research side, then there's actually a lot of doctors involved.
Do you have a website, or do these other doctors have a website? Is there a place people can go for this unique information?
Yes, people could look at my website, which is openmindedmd.com.
Oh, I love that. That's an oxymoron. Open-minded. That's
a great
website.
Well, because I had this experience that opened my mind, I decided, you know what, maybe that's just what I should use.
So it's openmindedmd. What?
.com.
.com. Openmindedmd.com. And is that going to give people an in to other folks, or is there any other websites you'd cite for this?
Well, let's see. You could, I'm not sure whether or not I should say the names of those other physicians because they might not want to get snowed under with emails.
Okay. Well,
I didn't actually ask their permission first.
We'll let you be the victim then.
Okay.
Nino, tell me about tell us all about mitochondrial disease in children, which is apparently the model for the beginning of your understanding of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, in children, it usually shows up fairly early in life, the first 3 to 6 months when you're supposed to notice that your baby's able to hold its head up or sit up on its own. In children, it often shows as muscle weakness because that's the thing that you can assess in a small child. If the kid's not talking yet, it's hard for you to know whether or not they have any memory loss. But muscle weakness is usually the parents become very aware of that. So that's one way in which it shows. Other ways in which it shows is seizures, because the dysfunction can lead to seizures. And so kids with seizures are usually, if they have more than one anyway, will be assessed by their pediatrician to see if they have any mitochondrial dysfunction. Maybe the parents don't even know that the pediatrician checked for that, but certainly the parent could ask the pediatrician to. One very interesting thing is that crib death, for a long time, nobody knew what was causing sudden infant death syndrome. It turns out that a lot of that has to do with carnitine metabolism, and carnitine is an amino acid that brings fats into mitochondria, and so sudden infant death often can have a mitochondrial component too.
And what is the treatment for that? You said there's no specific treatment for the children that's been developed, or is there?
Right. No, there's really not. What they do is, because the mitochondria are known to have so many different biochemical pathways, and you have to support the mitochondrial function, and you do that by giving, for instance, antioxidants. Certain ones in particular are good for the mitochondria. And a lot of people have heard about free radicals or oxidative stress. What they don't know is that almost all the free radicals in your body are being generated in your mitochondria. That's because the way that your body produces this ATP molecule is it takes electrons and it moves them down something called the electron transport chain, in which the electron gets transferred from one enzyme to the next enzyme to the next enzyme. Ultimately, what that does, it turns the mitochondria itself into a little tiny battery that's negatively charged on one side of the membrane, positively charged on the other. And you utilize this electrical gradient to create energy to make the ATP molecule, and then extra electrical energy is it chemically stored in the ATP molecule, and you can use it later when you need energy. That all sounds pretty complicated, but the fact of the matter is if you start to have mitochondrial dysfunction, those negatively charged electrons are not sequestered inside the mitochondria. They start to leak out. Those are free radicals. That's where oxidative stress comes from in your body. Almost all of it comes from the mitochondria. One other place in your body you can get free radicals is actually in your liver when you're detoxifying compounds. So there's one other place, but in general it mostly comes from the mitochondria. So certain types of antioxidants that are specific to the mitochondria, like CoQ10 and lipoic acid in the right doses for the right person, are some of the mitochondrial support nutrients. Avoiding things that stress you, avoiding working long hours, avoiding getting dehydrated, avoiding confrontational or hostile situations in which you start to feel emotionally stressed. all of these things are important for people with mitochondrial illness because they don't have the same response to stress that other people do. And in fact, stress itself can turn off mitochondrial function or dampen it down and make the disease worse. And so basically, you have to really learn how to take good care of yourself if you have a mitochondrial problem. Kind of like you have to do no matter what kind of illness you have. And the fascinating thing for me is seeing the connection between the mitochondria, which are all over your body, brain function, which in my case has to do with memory, but for lots of people has to do with depression or anxiety or fear or tension, stress. All of these things are highly connected to your immune system and the inflammation levels in your body, and also connected to your called the fight or flight system, you know, your ability to release adrenaline. And so all of these are hooked together through pathways that all move through the mitochondria. And therefore, by working with mitochondrial function, you can help people with psychiatric problems. You can help people who are just, quote, nervous, you know, who are always stressed out and turned on and can't fall asleep. And you can also help people with problems like diabetes or obesity, because diabetes and obesity both have to do with fat metabolism, and that all happens in the mitochondria.
Tell me about the board of holistic medicine. What is the history of that? There's so many things here that you're involved in that I have so little familiarity with or knowledge about.
Right.
What is that?
Well, there's actually more than one board of holistic type medicine or alternative medicine in America. The one that I belong to is the American Board of Integrative and Holistic Medicine. That one's been around about 15 years. They're affiliated with a lot of different medical residency programs, like the famous one in Arizona that was started by Dr. Andrew Weil, also with the integrative medicine program at Scripps in San Diego. I believe Harvard has one of these programs. A lot of the residency programs are now moving towards allowing people to get their board certification just in integrative medicine. And I believe
so
there's about 25.
This is one of the regular boards then,
Nina? It is. It is one of the regular boards, and there's about 25 medical institutions that now can give you this board certification. So if you're a medical student listening, you should look into that. It's the ABIHM, American Board of Integrative and Holistic Medicine. They've got their website, abihm.org.
One of my friends is a doc who got injured by medical care, and I'll bet a lot of people who have gotten poor medical care as doctors, which has happened to me too, and to my wife, end up beginning to look in this direction.
And I think it's only natural. You know, unfortunately, what's been happening, medicine's been getting smaller and smaller in scope in the past 10 to 20 years. It used to be you'd see your doctor, and your doctor had learned the science of medicine, but had a very personal approach to how they practice the art of medicine. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of market pressure that's changing the face of medicine. Maybe patients don't know it, but nowadays, in order for a doctor to get paid by Medicare or by an insurance company, that doctor has to submit their claim on the computer. So you will notice now, if you go in and get a medical visit with a doctor, 9 doctors out of 10, the computer's in the room right there. The doctor's sitting there typing on the computer while they speak to you. And this definitely interferes with your ability to communicate with your doctor. But if the doctor doesn't do that, they won't get paid. The other thing is reimbursements have dropped dramatically since I started in medicine. Sometimes the doctor might get maybe $20 for seeing you if they're in primary care. That means they've got to cycle through about 6 patients an hour just to meet the bills. So they have to move. They don't have time to talk to you. They don't have time to think about complicated or simple or elegant or unusual solutions to your problems. They just want to quickly scribble you a prescription and get out of the room so they can go on to the next one. And I don't really want to blame doctors for that, because they're kind of stuck. They've signed contracts with these insurance companies and can't really get out of them. In order for them to stop taking insurance, they have to either move to a different area where that insurance is no longer allowed, is not accepted, or they have to wait 2 years before they practice again in the community where they've built up their practice. So they're really you know, if you sign one of those contracts with a major insurer, you're kind of screwed. You're stuck. And luckily for me, I never signed one. That was just, at first, it wasn't a conscious decision that I made. It was just the way it worked out. And then later, when I saw what was happening in medicine, I was like, ooh, I don't want to go there. So I think
I want to be on the side of doctors,
but I also want to say, you know, patients are getting failed by the system.
Let me go back to that, because I'm hearing things I've not known about, a couple of things. One, I want to go over again a little bit with you what the doc's doing when he's looking at his computer, because I have that experience too. And as a psychiatrist, I just don't even get near any of that kind of issue. So you're saying a lot of what he's doing is note-taking for the diagnosis? And then I had another question.
Well, you shouldn't even call it note-taking, because most of those computer programs have very limited text entry fields. He's tapping from selection to selection to make sure that he fills in all the hot spots on that computerized form that will guarantee that he gets paid.
Because if he's clicking
on one of those buttons, if he doesn't click the button, then the insurance company gets to say, you filled it out wrong, I don't have to pay you.
God, I thought he might be taking notes, or he might be looking up something. Oh, God.
That would be a better use of the computer. but that's not what's going on, unfortunately.
Now, my second question is this amazing thing that you just taught me, that when you've signed up for one of these insurance, with one of these insurance companies, which I do not do, I don't join anybody's board, but often I'm covered just by a basic insurance policy, but sometimes not, because I don't belong to any of the panels or boards. So if you sign up for one of those and then you get disillusioned, you're stuck for 2 years or got to leave town?
At least 2 years. That's the standard contract clause. It's a non-compete agreement. They don't want you to open your doors in a community and take their insurance and then have a whole bunch of patients start to like you, and then, well, they'll go see you anyway even if you stop taking their insurance. They want their patients to be captive to their insurance company, and they want the doctors to also be captive to the insurance provider. So
this is really, really interesting to me. I hope that you'll write something about this, and we can communicate after the show about it. I think both of these issues are extraordinarily interesting, and under healthcare, national healthcare, it's going to be interesting to see what happens, because we can be sure it will get worse.
You're pretty sure of that too. From the personal point of view, I'm in favor of socialized medicine. I think it's highly unfair that the broad swath of the middle class doesn't have coverage when the extremely poor and the extremely rich have coverage. I just don't think that shouldn't be the way the world is, especially when the broad swath of the middle class are the people who are working and who are productive. And if they get sick, then for God's sake, we should take care of them so we can get them back to work and back into meaningful lives and back into society. And so I'm in favor of socialized medicine, but I think socialized medicine will make these types of things even worse. There's no doubt about it. The bureaucracy/paperwork issue will get worse.
I'm not in favor of socialized medicine. I share some of your concerns, but I know many of the states have programs that cover people in a variety of ways. But I'll let that issue go. There's a lot of other people talking back and forth about socialized medicine. I don't think it's my major contribution. We're going to finish up for a break in a minute. I wanted to tell folks that this is your first radio show, you told me, since you had one a million years ago in college.
We won't say how long ago that was.
You're doing a great job. On your first radio show. What a pleasure to introduce you to radio. And I think it's just marvelous to have you on. When we come back, I want to talk with you about the whole idea of the importance of relationship. Of a caring relationship. Yes, thanks for being with me, Nino Alexandri Quirk, Dr. Quirk, holistic medicine doc. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, having a very interesting time with my guest, Dr. Nino Alexandri Quirk. Nino, would you tell me at least the origins of your beautiful first name?
Oh, Nino is actually, I believe, a Maltese name originally. You know, I've tried to look it up. It's a mixture of my great-grandmother's name, which was a different four-letter name, hyphen Alexandri, and I've lived in Hawaii for a long time, and so I developed a nickname based on the Hawaiian language, which was Ninu or Ninua. And so when I got married and changed my last name, I decided to change my first name also because everyone calls me by my nickname and no one called me by my birth name. So I figured I would just, in one fell swoop, I was changing all my licenses, medical license, driver's license. I'd put my name up there and make it real, the thing that everyone called me. So it's not the name I was born with, but it's the name that I sort of acquired through life.
And the Alexandri part?
That's from my great-grandmother.
Okay. It's a lovely name.
Thank you.
It's a very, very lovely, and it's a name that begs to be asked about.
That's true. You're certainly not the first.
I'm sure not the first. Let's continue and tell me first. Oh, I always like to ask, how'd you get to know about me? I know you contacted us at one point recently, or my wife. And that's how I got interested in you, invited you on the show. How did you get interested in us? How far back does that go?
You know, I'm not sure exactly when it was, but it's several years ago now. I had a patient come in, and she was telling me about how her teenager was taking an antidepressant, and she was quite concerned that this might cause her teenager to commit suicide, and told me that, you know, there was new evidence coming out that these SSRIs like Prozac, these antidepressants, could cause young people to commit suicide. And I certainly didn't disagree with her, but, you know, the little script that went off in my head was, oh, well, that can't be true. You know, it's just that depressed people sometimes commit suicide, and people are probably confusing those two things. But because this patient told me this, I decided, you know what, I need to look into this. And I did look into it, and it was right around the time that you were testifying before Congress, so of course you were kind of right up there in the public eye. And that was my first introduction to recognizing that the pharmaceutical industry has been, shall we say, other than honorable in some of their marketing plans.
Yeah.
And that they had evidence that some of their drugs were harmful. And, you know, they had evidence these drugs were harmful, and they withheld the evidence not only from the FDA and from doctors, but from patients, and put advertisements out there to encourage people to take these drugs, making them think, you know, this is really wonderful, this is going to help you so much, when, in fact, maybe it will end your child's life. I was stunned by that. And then another book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, by Robert Whittaker, was another thing that really influenced me and gave me a great deal of information on exactly how this, shall we say, fraud was perpetrated. And I don't mean to be totally against the pharmaceutical industry, because I think that there are things they do that are good. And I know individuals who work in the pharmaceutical industry who are very altruistic and really want to help people. But I think the people in charge of the marketing and finance probably should be pilloried.
Yeah, you'll get no disagreement here.
People, you know?
It's just so hard to accept that, you know, that there's a whole industry that is fundamentally so driven by profit motive that it loses track of the well-being of the people for whom it's making products. I got into this whole thing strictly through psychiatry. And for years and years, you know, I would say, well, I don't know about the rest of the industry. This is my specialty. And then the more I learned and the more I listened and the more I also paid attention to what my wife Ginger was telling me, it became increasingly apparent that much the same process was taking place elsewhere, that when a level was established for obesity, drug company people would be involved in that, because the lower the level would be, the more so-called treatments would be needed, that if the level of cholesterol in your blood, if the margins for that were lowered, then again, more cholesterol drugs would be needed. Yeah, and the same with hypertension drugs. And then you compare things in England, where there's a little less influence, and you know, they won't treat you for blood pressure until you get to a much higher level than in America. So, and you read the cholesterol science and read books by people like Thomas Moore, and you find out that that most of that's fake. So, wow. But it makes sense.
Yeah, it is. It's overwhelming. And this whole concept of evidence-based medicine that's now driving medicine and driving prescription practices, you know, that thing, evidence-based medicine, that's an oxymoron. The evidence changes every day. There's new research. You can't be going out there and first of all, a lot of the research is tainted by the pharmaceutical industry, which only will publish the research they want you to see. They're not required to publish the research that shows that their drugs failed. You know, they could have 20 studies, 17 of them might show failure and 3 show success, and then they'll only publish the 3 that show success. So the whole thing is biased. It's really not appropriate.
Well, then if you then look at the 3 that show success, you know, you find out they really didn't once you look at them, or you find the studies were literally, in most cases now, ghostwritten by the drug companies who paid docs to stick their names on them. It's just way out of control. But I'm not in favor of socializing this process. I'm in favor of hammering fraud. But that's also hard to get the opportunity to do. Well, let's go to a happier note. Tell me about your development in terms of appreciating how important the relationship is in medicine and even in physical medicine.
Well, I've been an appreciator of relationship, I guess, all my life. You know, that is the juice of being alive, is having good relationships. And when I became a doctor, I think it was pretty obvious to me early on that if I took the time to listen, if I took the time to explain, and that if I was empathic with people, that they would trust me and that they would actually listen to my advice, because if they don't listen to my advice, they wouldn't get better. I remember, might not get better, I remember reading a study when I was still in medical school, and it said that one-third of prescriptions are never even filled, and those other two-thirds, half of them are filled and not taken as directed, and then that leaves only one-third of prescriptions being filled and taken as directed. Now, that made me think that doctors were doing a lousy job of explaining to patients why they should take this, or, you know, what the side effects might be, and, you know, stick through these side effects because you won't get the benefit until blah, 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 or whatever. People just don't communicate. And if you don't trust the person who tells you to take this little pill, then why would you take it? That, you know, basically those statistics shows that two-thirds of patients don't do what the doctor tells them to do. I would say that's a terrible vote of no confidence. And so I early on wanted to make sure that people understood where I was coming from, give them a chance to tell me what they thought about it. You know, if you write someone a prescription for a medicine that dad took and had a bad reaction to, they're never going to take it. And if you don't give them a chance to tell you that, oh, you know what, I won't take that, then you won't give them some other alternative that might be appropriate for them, better than the one that they have a feeling they should be on. So it started like that, just a matter of good listening. But realistically, you know, I was in family practice for 15 years before I moved into integrative medicine. And when you're a family practice doctor, a lot of people come see you crying, upset about what's going on in their life, really in distress. And I had to be, at least me as an individual, as a human being, I had to be open to that. I had to really feel, here's a suffering human being asking me for my help. And I felt the best way to help a person who's suffering is by being kind and loving and considerate and kind of creating an atmosphere of warmth. I think it takes a lot for a person to walk into a doctor's office and confess or admit or whatever, I'm depressed. Very few people feel comfortable saying that. Unfortunately, our society doesn't really support people who are going through mood difficulties. And so it takes a lot for a patient to say that. And I think if a patient has the courage to do that, that I need to step up to the plate and give them the kind of care that they deserve.
I think it's so true. And, you know, somewhat related, one of the worst offenses, which I recently got reminded of, is when you go in with a medical problem that the doctor doesn't understand, and particularly if it's dealing with something that hasn't yet been discovered, like all we now know about how bad the mesh implants into women for surgery, how bad they are and how what kind of pain they produce, or is going in, you're going in with terrible fatigue effects and achy effects from the cholesterol drugs and things like that. Have the doctor look at you and say, it's all in your head, you need an antidepressant.
Oh, I know. It's terrible.
It's absolutely terrible.
Or like I was blown off and told, oh, you're just menopausal.
So that, oh, yeah, there's
really
another one.
For me. And honestly, the couple of doctors who said that to me, I do think they're, quote, good doctors. They certainly aren't jerks. They just didn't have any answers. And it's so hard for a doctor to say, oh, I don't know. That's really not
right.
In the vocabulary of the way we're educated.
Right. Or even... Well, let's take a little more time and tell me more.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more, which is, you know, when I talk to students about doing therapy, and when you're confused and when you can't figure out what's going on, you just smile, relax, and say, "Tell me more." And somebody's going to learn something if the patient keeps talking to you.
And you were speaking of chronic fatigue a minute ago. That's when I check the mitochondrial function on chronic fatigue patients, half of them actually have mitochondrial dysfunction. And you can work with that and make the chronic fatigue go away. Chronic fatigue has a bunch of different sources. Some of them are from the mitochondria and some aren't. But you can really change somebody's life. Chemically sensitive people often have mitochondrial dysfunction, or the poor chemically sensitive individuals have all been labeled as, quote, nut cases. You know, that's so not fair. These people have been poisoned. And, you know, and modern medicine, a very, very sad thing is that the industries that make the pesticides and the toxic paints and the fluorine, the off gases, chemicals that's bad for you, those industries are connected to the industries that make pharmaceuticals. And there's been a real effort on the part of the pharmaceutical industry not to recognize multiple chemical sensitivity as a genuine diagnosis, which I do believe it is. There are people whose livers are not good at detoxifying chemicals. The modern world is full of all kinds of new chemicals that our bodies did not develop to be able to detoxify. And if you happen to not be a fast detoxifier, you're kind of screwed. You're going to get sick from normal exposures that somebody like me maybe wouldn't be affected by.
I live in farm country, and I know many of the farmers who've spent their lives in the fields, including the men who own huge farms. They spend a lot of their time in the fields.
Absolutely.
Worry a great deal about cancer and other things that their families have been exposed to, and of course I'm sure the industry that makes the stuff we spread on our crops is probably at least as unwilling as the psychiatric industry to psychopharmaceutical industry to look into these effects.
Yes, but what I'm trying to say is that those are actually the same companies. Dow, Syngenta, and Monsanto are all hooked into corporations like Bayer and Novartis, et cetera.
Thank you for reminding me of that. Yes, that's a very important information. It's wonderful to hear how much... Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm not an anti-corporation kind of human being. I think corporations are a great idea. They just have to be run responsibly. If they're not run responsibly, it destroys people's health. It destroys the environment. It's a lose-lose ultimate situation.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you, where did you, I'm very interested in people learning about and me learning about more about the holistic medicine. I have physician mm-hmm. friends who are wondering about it. Where did you get your training in it?
From a variety of sources, but the board that I belong to does an annual conference that's like 10 days long, and that's a really great place to start. There's another group called the Institute for Functional Medicine. They're holistic related too. They also give a very good week-long conference. If you're interested and you're a physician and you want to open your mind, expand yourself, then you could go to one of these conferences and learn a great deal. And the beautiful thing nowadays about alternative medicine, at least on the MD level, is that this is all science-based. There's research behind this stuff. It's not just, oh, you know, drink this funny-tasting tea and you'll get better. It's not really, I don't mean to disrespect anyone who's an herbalist, but it's not just guesswork anymore. There really is a growing body of literature that is just as valid as the science that's being promulgated by the pharmaceutical industry, and maybe more valid because, for the most part, the people who are making this research don't have products to sell. So that's kind of important.
Yeah, that's vastly, vastly important. Oh, golly. It's such a big world out there. In the whole nutritional field, the alternative medicine field, it really does make my head spin. And I feel like, my gosh, I would have to do enough research to practically become board certified for me to figure out mm-hmm. what I believed in and what I didn't. And
right. Well,
I welcome your efforts. I want to really tell you that. I welcome your efforts. I'm so glad to be talking with you. Yeah, well, go ahead, Neil.
It took me about 2 years to reach critical mass with the new knowledge base, and I think that's a reasonable time for any doctor who's good at, you know, reading literature and understanding what medical things mean. Some people might be able to make the segue faster, but then again, you also have to factor in time for actually practicing in the new way, seeing what works and what doesn't. So it's definitely a transition in one's career. It can be difficult. It's probably easier if you just start that way in residency. But, you know, I don't know if we have time left, but I did want to talk a little about some of the alternative pathways for depression, because, you know, everyone talks about serotonin and thinks that depression is a serotonin deficiency or something. And I think that there's a lot of other pathways that can create depression in addition to the neurotransmitters. So do you think we have a minute for that?
Well, yes, if my spinning head doesn't make a loud whooshing noise and interfere, because I just don't believe in biological origins for depression. But yes,
right.
We have about 8 minutes, I think, and I'll get a good 2-minute warning, I'm sure, from my marvelous engineer.
Okay.
So
well,
go ahead.
I think something that's quite important is people who are depressed, there's a subset of depressed people who have a lot of inflammation in their body. And these people don't usually respond to the SSRIs or any other type of antidepressant prescription, but they usually do respond to things that decrease inflammation. And I think that that's something that doctors in general, psychiatrists or family doctors, are not testing for. And simple tests that you're already doing, like C-reactive protein, are measures of inflammation that can indicate whether or not this person's depression has an inflammatory component. So the other things that are less frequently measured, like interleukin-6 or TNF-alpha, these other inflammatory mediators, in the research studies, they measure them. And in the subset of people who are depressed and have high inflammation, all of these inflammatory markers are really high. And those people can get better. I personally don't use anti-inflammatory prescriptions to reduce the inflammation. I personally check people's fatty acid profiles. Because think about it, where do these inflammatory mediators come from in the body? They come from the fat you eat. And so if I look at somebody's fatty acid profile and they have really high levels of arachidonic acid and really low levels of omega-3s, for instance, well, there's an imbalance that I can fix nutritionally. And a lot of times when you do that, those people get better. Their depression goes away because you've given them the anti-inflammatory fats, whereas before their diet only gave them pro-inflammatory fats. Now, the place where the research kind of falls apart is that if you do a study of, say, 10,000 depressed people and you give them all omega-3 fatty acids, it'll look like it's only about as good as placebo. That's because you got all the depressed people in there, the ones with the inflammatory depression and the ones who had depression for some other reason. But if you do a subpopulation of just patients who have very high inflammatory markers and you check their fatty acid levels and you work with them to increase their anti-inflammatory fatty acids, those people have a very high response rate to treatment. And that's just one example. There's other examples with methyl tetrahydrofolate, which is a B vitamin, and that is concerned with your homocysteine level, which is another measure of one carbon metabolism in the body. And so I don't have time to describe all of them, but there's three or four different places I look when I get a patient who's depressed. And I also look and I see what kind of neurotransmitter metabolites are in their urine. Are these people really, really high on serotonin? If you have a lot of hydroxytryptophan in your urine, that means that your body eats tryptophan, puts it into serotonin, and then it gets blocked there. You're missing an enzyme or missing a vitamin that then will allow you to take that serotonin and transform it into melatonin and chymurinate, and ultimately it turns into niacin. And you need vitamin B6 to do that. And so the people who are peeing out high levels of serotonin or serotonin metabolites have a blockage in that biochemical pathway. And you can actually treat them by giving them B6 and B3, and a lot of them get better. Again, if you look at a giant population of depressed people and you give them all B6 and B3, it only works about as good as placebo. But if you tested and found the individual's metabolic blueprint, and then you treat them based on that. So that's what my new practice of medicine is about. It's looking at all kinds of biochemical markers, sometimes looking at genetic typing, to find out, you know, what makes this person tick? How can I explain the symptoms they have based on their underlying physiology?
You know,
and,
yeah, go ahead.
Are we running out of time?
Couple of minutes, but I had a couple of things I wanted to say about it. I have no doubt that many things can contribute to people feeling depressed, many physical things. I start to get depressed the minute I get cold symptoms.
Right, that's the inflammation you're talking.
Well, that's interesting because I've always thought it was because the fatigue that comes along with it doesn't allow me to do the things I want to do. So, I mean, that's interesting. That's two somewhat related, and I'll put alternative explanations. I certainly think if people have an underlying genuine inflammation, it could certainly lead to their feeling depressed. Those are things, I mean, just like if you got a hit in the head, it can lead you to be depressed. Or if you've got a viral infection, it can lead you to be depressed. But the place where I really depart from you, I think, is I don't see any evidence that serotonin or any other biochemical function in the brain is in any way related to depression. Certainly not serotonin. So that's where you and I would depart. Nor would I think that the serotonin levels in the urine or even the spinal cord or the metabolites in the urine or the spinal cord would necessarily reflect much about the intricacies of what goes on in the brain. So we've got some differences, but I'm very glad to see you exploring these other approaches. I'm surprised actually we are coming to an end a little quicker than I expected. I am so happy to be the first show host of my guest, Nino Alexandri Quirk. Dr. Quirk, thanks really much for being on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and then we'll stay in touch. Bye-bye now.